But if it sort of dampens demand because the thought is out there that now solar is no longer going to be affordable, that would be really unfortunate.
But Wisconsin utility company WEC Energy Group says the price impacts on their planned solar projects are manageable, and solar still makes the most sense for customers. Mary Lee Williams, Wisconsin Public Radio.
10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD sports and weather. NBA, the Bucks are off tonight. The Bulls play in Philadelphia. NHL, the Blackhawks are home tonight against Toronto. College basketball, Marquette takes on number 8, Xavier. Now the forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday the 24th. Cloudy, scattered morning flurries, a high of 33. Right now, wind from the northwest at 3, it's 26 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath, 8:11, The Morning Show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, over the course of the many decades that I have been doing this morning show program, it has been a pleasure and privilege to explore a whole series of extraordinary books. But I don't think I'm overstating it when I say that I have never read a book that was more eye-opening and more relentlessly fascinating than the book that we're going to be talking about today. It is titled The Written World: The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization. The author is Dr. Martin Puckner, who is the Byron and Anita Wien Professor of Drama and English and Comparative Literature at Harvard University. He has written a number of different important books and is also editor of the best-selling Norton Anthology of World Literature. In this newest book, he is really exploring the force that the written word has been through world history, and the way in which the written word has shaped history and driven history and led to some of mankind's most important discoveries and developments and accomplishments. In other words, we would not be who we are, the world would not be what it is without the written word. And this is something that maybe on some level we have a vague notion of, but this book explores that intriguing possibility, that intriguing idea in remarkable detail, in part by exploring some of the really crucial moments in history when dramatic steps forward were made in the way in which human beings write, or in the way in which those writings would be preserved and disseminated to the rest of the world. The book is published by Random House. Again, it is titled The Written World: The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization. And Professor Martin Puckner, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
I'm honored to be speaking with you. I was really quite intrigued by where the book began. I knew what the book was about, but it's one of those moments where you open it up wondering, where is the author going to begin this extraordinary odyssey of exploration? You begin it, interestingly enough, with the three astronauts aboard Apollo 8. Explain to our listeners why your book begins here.
Yeah, so Apollo 8 is this, for me, fascinating moment because it wasn't Apollo 11, it was not landing on the moon, but it was the first time that humans left the orbit of the Earth, the Apollo 8 was going to circle the moon and then come back. So it was the first time also that humans were able to see Earth from a distance, from afar, as a single whole. And it was on that Apollo 8 mission that one of the astronauts shot the famous photo. It's called Earthrise, where you see Earth rising above the horizon of the moon. But what fascinated me about it is the literary dimension of it, namely that at that moment, at that historic moment when humans for the first time were sitting out there in space and looking back at Earth, that they used one of the great creation myths we humans have developed, namely the opening of the Bible, the opening of Genesis. They disappeared with every rotation around the moon. They disappeared to the far side of the moon. They would be without radio contact for about 50 minutes. And when they reappeared, and there was always a lot of nail-biting whether they would reappear, but when they reappeared finally, they had prepared this reading, this message, and took turns reading from the opening of Genesis. And it showed to me the extent to which we humans use these old grand stories when we are trying to reorient ourselves in a new world. And that was so miraculously, this creation myth was so perfect for being recited at that moment from space. And that, for me, sort of captured the importance of stories and raised the questions I explore in the book. How do these, I call them foundational texts, how did they emerge? How did they survive?
Mm. And by the way, as you describe this memorable moment in which these three Apollo astronauts read that famous text from Genesis, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, you make a point that is in a sense so obvious that that the typical author might not even take the time to make it. And yet it really isn't all that obvious a point, and it's important that it be said in this context. And it's a point about the importance of human beings being in that space capsule versus a chimp or the dog Laika or some other kind of being who would not be able to respond in that moment the way these three astronauts did. Say a word about that.
Yeah, so, you know, there was a lot of debate, and still is, whether manned missions to the moon or to Mars is really what will advance science. And there are a lot of people who claim that unmanned probes with automated scientific experiments and so on and so forth would be much cheaper and serve as well. But what really brought home the importance of humans in space is the way in which these three astronauts expressed their impressions and this unique situation, and they expressed it with this reading of Genesis, but also in other ways. There were moments on the mission when the video technology started to fail or didn't quite work as well, and ground control told the astronauts that you poets need to start to use words to describe what you see, and poets they became, and all three poets really captured that experience and what they saw and how they felt and how they responded to being the first humans out there at a considerable distance from Earth. Through wonderful words, through almost spontaneous poetry, and the way these three astronauts, who weren't literary types at all, did that is something that I find very moving.
We're speaking with Professor Martin Puckner about his brand new book called The Written World: The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization. You've already mentioned in your remarks a term that is crucial to our understanding of what you are talking about and exploring in this book, namely the term foundational text. Let's take a moment to really sort out that text, what you mean by it, and how crucial it is to all that we explore in this book.
Yeah, so I look at 4,000 years of literature. Writing was invented almost 5,000 years ago, but only used to write down stories about 4,000 years ago. That's when the first great texts of literature emerged. And what I was struck by this bird's eye view of 4,000 years of literature is the importance of these often early texts, but texts that become reference points for entire cultures. And they do that because they answer basic questions that we all have, namely, where do we come from? Why are we here? Why are we in this particular place on Earth rather than another place? What holds our community together? Where are we going? These really fundamental questions. And so these texts answer them. They tell grand stories about the world and a particular nation and ancestors. And through that storytelling, they become sort of the cultural DNA of an entire region or nation. And that's why they endure over time. Looking at these 4,000 years and thinking about all the texts that were lost really attuned me to the fact that if a piece of written storytelling is to survive, it has to be used by every generation. It has to be relevant to every generation. So a lot of resources go into that survival, and these foundational texts manage to survive in part because they fulfilled this human need to tell stories about foundational stories about who we are, and this is how they survive.
Right, and they mattered not only to whoever wrote them and whoever first read them, but they mattered to somebody who came after and who came after that. In at least generally speaking, an unbroken chain. That is how these texts truly survive. That's how we can continue to be able to read them, for instance, and understand them.
Yeah, and so it is usually an unbroken chain. There are some exceptions to that, and I'm fascinated by them because they're so rare. The Epic of Gilgamesh is one of them. It was really the first great foundational story written in Mesopotamia, what's today Iraq, where writing was first invented, and it became important for hundreds of years, for over 1,000 years, but then it disappeared. But the fortunate thing was that it was written on clay tablets, and that meant that when the libraries in which it was housed and stored burned down, the Epic of Gilgamesh didn't burn. On the contrary, as we know, when clay burns, it gets harder, and it's like it being burned in a kiln. And so these clay tablets were buried underground, but on these hardened clay tablets. And that meant that when 2,000 years later, in the 19th century, people started to dig around that area, they were able to unearth this forgotten masterpiece and painstakingly decipher it. So that to me is an astonishing story, and there are few others like it. But there are exceptions, because for the most part, I would say that if a text wants to survive, it needs to be continually used by every generation, by every new generation of readers and listeners, and that means that these texts often become enshrined in education. So the Homeric epics, for example, anyone who would learn to read and write Greek, ancient Greek, would do it by studying the Homeric epics, the Odyssey and the Iliad, and that's why they became so enshrined in their culture.
Mm-hmm. In this introduction to your book, you draw our attention to something that now is so easy to take for granted. In some ways, it's almost impossible not to take it for granted because it is such a pervasive part of human life. And yet, it really matters, in a sense, for us to stop and understand and appreciate this. I'm talking about the moment when storytelling intersected with writing. And you tell us this is the moment that literature was born, and that the entire history of literature springs out of this moment of intersection. One of the things, of course, that's frustrating is that this moment, by its very nature, is almost entirely unknown to us, in a sense. But tell us what we know about why these worlds intersected, the world of oral tradition that came before versus the notion of writing stories down.
Yeah. So it is a tantalizing moment, and you wish you were there and witness it, which is of course impossible, as you say, Greg. But what's interesting to me about that moment, what we can reconstruct from it, is that the first uses of writing weren't at all to write down important stories. Writing was invented for very mundane reasons, to write down an economic transaction. You know, I sell you 3 cows, and here we write down the contract. For administrative purposes, the first scribes created bureaucracies that ran really the first urban centers, and with writing they were able to project their power into the hinterland. So they were accountants. And it was only after hundreds of years that one of these accountants decided to use this technique, this bureaucratic technique, to do something completely different, and that is to write down a story. Now, stories had been told orally wherever humans have existed, but at that moment, this new accounting technique, namely writing, and oral storytelling intersected, and that for me is sort of the big bang of literature, and the 4,000 years of literature, the story of literature I tell, really begins at that moment.
Right. I think what is so intriguing about that history of literature, and this is also something you point out in your introduction, is that it is not the straight, unbroken path that most of us imagine it to be. I mean, I think most of us think of it as the moment that early man discovered fire, and from there fire led to this, and fire led to that, and to the thing after it, and the thing after it, in this steady progression of progress. And at least when it comes to writing, this was a breakthrough that not everybody welcomed, and that some cultures very much feared and actively resisted. Just say a word about what was, for some, so disconcerting about the notion of writing down stories and preserving them.
Yeah, it was very clear to people early on what a powerful tool writing was, and that created a lot of anxiety, as you just said, Greg. And so I focus on four, I call them charismatic teachers, who emerged within a few hundred years of each other in the ancient world, the Buddha, Confucius, Socrates, and Jesus. And what I found so interesting about them is that they lived in very literate cultures, cultures with scribes and schools and these foundational texts. So they could have written, and they had a lot to say, but they decided not to. They refused to write, and they chose to teach their students and followers face to face. And it was only the students who wrote down their words after these teachers had died, to preserve their words and deeds and pass them on to future generations. And of those four teachers, it was Socrates who was most explicit about the reasons why he refused to write. And Greece at the time was one of the most literate places on earth, in part because that's where the first full alphabet was used, which made reading and writing much easier, which allowed more people to participate in it. But Socrates refused, and he refused for a couple of reasons. The first was that he worried that writing, trusting this external storage device would be bad for memory. We would no longer need to know things in our own minds because we would trust these pieces of papyrus on which we had written things. So loss of memory, trusting everything on these other devices. The other worry he had was that you can't ask a written text follow-up questions, right? You can't ask it to clarify something. And that means he saw a lot of room for misunderstanding, for taking words out of context. So he just thought that would be written communication. The more we would communicate by writing, the more misunderstanding would arise. And so, so these were some of his reasons. But more important, there are all these important charismatic teachers who didn't write, and we know about them only because their students, in a way, betrayed their teachers. They used writing where their teachers had deliberately not. Though this betrayal is good for us because that's how we know about Jesus and Socrates and the Buddha and Confucius and some other of these teachers.
Fascinating. As you take us through this long arc of the history of literature, you spell it out in four stages. And I would love for you to spell these out for our listeners right now. But I also want you to explain whether or not this is something that has been long understood, or if this is a framework which you yourself have really developed.
Yeah, I sort of have. I mean, it's of course true if you write about 4,000 years of literature that I rely on a lot of very specialized research, especially in these ancient languages. So it's a book of synthesis that relies on archaeologists who discover texts and decipher them and comment on them and translate them. So, you know, it's in a way I rely on a lot of work by generations and hundreds of and even thousands of years of commentators and scholars and translators. But one of the things that happens when you take a bird's eye view, and a lot of people for very good reasons don't want to do that because it's hard and it's difficult to keep all these balls in the air. But one of the things you do, one of the advantages I think, is that you start to notice patterns that you only see when you really look at the whole picture. So one of the pictures that emerged for me is these different stages where you have different kinds of texts that dominate at different times. We already talked about a little bit the Epic of Gilgamesh and these first foundational texts that tell us who we are and where we come from. And so those I see dominating in a kind of first stage. The next stage is one that is very familiar to us, namely the idea of holy scripture. Right, we live in a world where all the world religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, they all based on scripture. But like all things, this idea of scripture had to be invented. We talked a moment ago about the very mundane origins of writing as an accounting technology. So it wasn't seen as holy or divine or having anything to do with religion for a time. But at some point, some of the stories that were written down were declared sacred. And one of the first was the Hebrew Bible. And I talk about how Ezra the scribe, when he comes back with his followers from Babylonian exile, builds a stage and holds up the Torah scrolls, the scrolls that tell the stories of the Jews, and demands that the people bow before these scrolls as if they were divine. And that for me is sort of the origin of that second stage where some of these foundational texts, some of these written stories become themselves an object of worship. And this is something that then really spreads and is part of all modern world religions, really. Then I go to a next stage that is in part fueled by some of these technologies that I focus on, technologies that make reading and writing cheaper and therefore more available to more people, and which means that more people participate in literature as readers and writers, and that means that new stories start to make it into the written world, and that often leads, or always, when these technological revolutions come along and lower the cost of literature, means that there's an explosion of popular storytelling. So in the late ancient world and throughout the Middle Ages, the kinds of texts that emerge suddenly as a very powerful new form of literature are these story collections, so that would be the next stage, and the most well-known of those is the Arabian Nights, the 1001 Nights, a fascinating collection of stories that, of course, we all grew up with because they've been adapted by so many people, from Disney to children's books and in other ways. And then we reach, through the printing press, really the age of mass literacy, and that's the world in which we live today, and that also brought new forms of storytelling, such as the novel or newspapers, and the other forms of writing that we all know so well. And so that's the last stage, the stage we're living in. And then, of course, the question is, where do we go from there? And I speculate a little bit towards the end about our own revolution in writing technologies that is yet again making reading and writing much more widely accessible. More people read and write than ever before, and that's going to change the kinds of story we tell yet again.
We are speaking with Professor Martin Puckner about his book, The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization. Before we explore a couple of the chapters in which you take us into very specific and important figures in this long and complex history, I want you to say a word about a decision that you made, namely that you were not going to write this book simply from the comfort of your office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but that you were determined to really crisscross the globe and seek out many of the very specific places which you talk about in order to explore this on an even deeper level. First of all, sort of tell us the extent to which you were able to do what I just described. I mean, exactly where did you end up going, and to what extent did it end up being as helpful as you hoped it might be?
Yeah, so, you know, as you put it, I just felt like here I was telling this global story about all these places. And I think a naturally curious person, and that's one reason why I ended up, why I wanted to write this book in the first place, to explore this vast terrain. And so at some point I thought it's just wrong to sit in my armchair and not go out and visit some of the places I was talking about. So I think that was sort of the original motivation, and it really changed things for me very profoundly. I mean, for one thing, you know, I don't only talk about these ancient long dead texts and authors. I talk about some living authors, and I wanted to talk to them, of course, like Derek Walcott in St. Lucia, or Orhan Pamuk in Istanbul, and that was one reason. But it also turned out to, for me, equally important to visit some of the ruins from some of the episodes I write about. For example, I have a chapter on Alexander the Great and the way he was inspired by Homer's Iliad to go on his huge campaign in through which he conquered parts of Asia in this breathtaking conquest. He slept on a copy of the Iliad every night, and he really thought he was reenacting the Iliad, the much older story of how a Greek navy attacked Troy in what's today Turkey and conquered Troy. So Alexander the Great, living many hundreds of years later, loved the story, had grown up with it, and it captured his mind, and it motivated him to go on this conquest. But so what I did, for example, I followed in his footsteps, and there are all these ruins of cities that he founded in what's today Turkey along the Aegean coast. And one of the things that struck me, which you know, I don't think I would have quite realized before, is that these cities, you know, often the walls have crumbled and the pillars have crumbled and you see only foundations. But there are two types of buildings, the largest buildings in these cities that still are partially standing usually, and those are libraries and theaters. And at some point it just hit me that, of course, these were the two institutions that were devoted to literature: libraries to, of course, house scrolls, and theaters to reenact these stories. And it just drove home this point for me, the extent to which these ancient civilizations had devoted enormous resources to literature.
Hmm. And so we have a sense just from that of how central this was to their lives.
Exactly.
Hmm. Let's at least dabble in some of what you explore in the heart and soul of your book. And, of course, we are leaving it to our listeners to explore this book on their own. There is no way we can possibly cover everything that is here. The first chapter is about Alexander the Great. And you tell us something very intriguing at the top of this first chapter, namely that through most of his travels, as he engaged in his extraordinary military campaigns, he had three objects with him. And they say a lot about what was important to him.
Yeah, so the first was a dagger. Alexander would always sleep with a dagger by his side because he had watched his father, the king of Macedonia in northern Greece, be assassinated in front of his very eyes. So he wanted to avoid that fate. The second object was a chest that he had taken from his foe, Darius, the leader of the Persian army, whom he had engaged in various battles, and that was really the heart of his campaign. It was the war with Persia, and he managed to capture that treasure chest from Darius, and he took that with him from then on. And the third is the one I just mentioned a moment ago, namely a copy of the Iliad, the text with which he had grown up and which he slept on every single night of his life. Took that copy with him on his entire campaign from Egypt into what's today Afghanistan and even India. And so those three objects, I think, really say a lot about Alexander's motivation. And this piece of literature, the Iliad, Homer's Iliad, is probably the most important of those three.
Hmm. In this chapter about Alexander, you, of course, talk about Homer and the Iliad, and you talk about the breakthrough made initially by the Phoenicians, at least in this part of the world, in terms of developing an alphabet versus the way in which ideas, concepts would have been sort of physically, visually conveyed before that. Just say a quick word about the shift that occurred at this moment that was so very, very important and makes possible everything that comes after.
It does. The alphabet is perhaps another thing we tend to take for granted, because so many parts of the world now use one alphabet or another, with the exception of East Asia. And it's interesting to see to the extent to which East Asia, especially China, has hold on to a non-alphabetic writing system. But for the most part, it's really the alphabet that's won, and for a very simple reason, namely that it is so simple to use. All you have to know is, you know, about 25 to 30 signs, and with those signs, you can express every word in any language you choose to express. And the reason why that's possible is because the alphabet only expresses sound, not meaning. That's the interesting thing about all these older writing systems. They are sometimes called ideographic or logographic. They didn't express sounds so much as ideas or things. So, and because of that, you know, there's they would often represent those things not by sounds but by shapes. So the shape of a cow, the shape of a star, the shape of justice, and because writing expressed ideas or meanings, of course, there was a proliferation of them. There were hundreds and hundreds of those signs, and that's why it was so hard to master writing in the ancient world. But it made sense to people that if you wanted to express language, you had to express meaning. The almost counterintuitive thing about the alphabet is that if you chop up words into individual sounds, they don't mean anything anymore. So you completely sever the connection between writing and meaning. But what you get in return is this immense simplicity, that all you need is to express sounds, and that when you put them back together, you have the meaning through words that way. And that's really the sort of conceptual breakthrough of the alphabet. And it had really enormous influence because it made reading and writing so much easier.
Right. And of course, one can well imagine how somebody used to a more pictorial way of conveying ideas would probably first look at an alphabet and see it as something sort of cold and lifeless.
Right.
To say nothing of completely mystifying beyond comprehension. But of course, someone with a little bit of vision and persistence could perhaps see beyond all that. One of your best stories in this chapter about Alexander the Great is about when he founds the city of Alexandria, Egypt. He makes a very important decision about the library at the heart of that city, located very close to the harbor. Alexandria was a major port. Explain the practice for the ships that would come into Alexandria.
Yeah, so that the librarians at Alexandria, they were very canny in how they operated. So because they were situated in this very important commercial harbor, they passed a law that every ship coming into harbor that contained any form of writing, any scroll of any significance, would have to lend it to the librarians. They would copy it. They had a vast army of copyists and scribes, and then they would return the text, and people could go on. But that way, because they established that law, that practice, that very, very far-sighted law, they managed to turn this library into the greatest library in the world.
Incredible. And it says a lot about who he was and what was important to him. One of the things I love about the second chapter, which is about the unearthing of this long-lost story of Gilgamesh, is that among the artifacts that have been found that point us to the time of Ashurbanipal is how scribes would be trained in this form of writing called cuneiform that was so complex and so difficult. Just say a word about the two-sided tablets that have been uncovered that, in a sense, bring us right into the heart of this moment from ancient history.
Yeah, so because writing was so difficult, there, of course, there had to be scribal schools set up, because writing was such a prized technique, kings especially immediately saw its importance and wanted to have a stable of scribes. And some kings, like Arshavanipal, even went to the trouble of learning how to read and write themselves. But that was the Arshavanipal, the Assyrian king in what is today Syria, was an exception. So for the most part, there were schools set up. And what I love about these fragments from shards of clay on which these students learned how to read and write is that they complain about their teachers being too hard on them and being taskmasters, and they don't want to do it, and they have to be talked into staying in school and mastering this difficult skill. And on the other hand, you have fragments from teachers who complain, of course, about how lazy their students are, and that students used to be much more interested in literature, and now they are no longer. They're interested in other things. And, you know, these exchanges, these fragments from 3,000-4,000 years ago, they sound like they could have been written yesterday.
Absolutely. It reminds me, too, that in the chapter that you devote to Confucius and the Buddha and Jesus, that you, especially as a university professor, enjoy on a very personal level the exploration of the writings of great teachers or writings about great teachers, because in a sense it turns you into a student again.
Exactly, and this is what these texts that the students wrote down really do with you. You feel like they transport you across time and space into the presence of these teachers, and you feel like you can talk to them almost, because the great thing these students did is that they knew why their teachers had not wanted to write, because the teachers really wanted that live dialogue with their students. So what the students did, they preserved that, and many of these texts surrounding these teachers are either almost like plays or at least show very vivid exchanges, show their teachers in conversation with their students, and it takes you right back there. And it's true. It's fun for me that I don't have to be always a teacher myself. I get to be a student again.
I do want to make sure before we run out of time that we spend a little time with Chapter 7. And maybe it's because I'm a Lutheran and the Lutherans of the world just celebrated an important 500th anniversary of Martin Luther and his theses. But this chapter is important even beyond that, because it tells the extraordinarily important story of Johannes Gutenberg, who, of course, is carelessly credited with inventing the printing press, which is not really quite the way it is. It is a more complicated picture than that. And part of what you tell us in this story is that most inventions do not spring out of the genius of a single person in isolation, but are very much created in collaboration. Briefly tell us the story of why it was Gutenberg who ended up, in a sense, perfecting the printing press or bringing it to a place of prominence that it had not had before.
Yeah, so the printing press was invented many centuries before Gutenberg in China, and Gutenberg knew some of that invention. We don't know exactly what he knew and how he knew it, but there was printing had actually primitive printing, for example, of playing cards and such things had existed in Europe by the time of Gutenberg. But what Gutenberg really did, and I feel like that is true of so many inventors, is that he recognized what could be done with print. And so he perfected the technique, he introduced innovations along the way, and he fundraised a lot of money. And I really think of him sort of as a startup media entrepreneur, like, I don't know, Mark Zuckerberg or Steve Jobs, because they, too, they often weren't the people who had the actual invention. They recognized how to use these inventions. And this is very much true of Gutenberg. He worked on perfecting the printing process. He created almost one of the first sort of industrial divisions of labor. He made it much faster and much higher quality so that by the end he could print beautiful books. So this is not to take away from Gutenberg, but he was really a genius. But what he was a genius in wasn't to have this sort of one idea, but it was several ideas, and then the determination to create a company that put that idea into practice.
And of course, we get a sense as we read about each and every step of the process, all that he did. I mean, to mass produce books, you had to figure out how to create all of these individual letters and to make them legible. And his, of course, innovation was to cast them in metal so they could print again and again and again. And then you have the idea of what kind of ink to use, how thick or how thin, and on what kind of paper, and how hard should it be pressed, and so on. I mean, and again, everything that we take completely for granted now, even more so than we once did because of the technological advancements that have been made. But it was Gutenberg who first perfected that. And oddly enough, because some of the first things he printed were leaflets from the church concerning indulgences, Gutenberg, in a sense, helped prime the pump for Martin Luther, who was somebody who was actually rather skeptical in the beginning about this newfangled new printing press.
Yeah, that for me is the most fascinating part. That there are many examples in my book and in history more generally of sort of unintended consequences, and I think this is one of them, where in the beginning the church was an early adopter of print. They thought print was great for printing these indulgences. It was almost like printing money. It was sort of one page, and then you would leave the name of the person who would buy the indulgence blank, and you would fill it in later by hand, and then you could just print hundreds and thousands, and in some cases tens of thousands of these indulgences and sell them. But the other, of course, text that Gutenberg printed is the Latin Bible. And again, the church was delighted by this because now they could replicate their sacred text, the Latin Bible, much more cheaply and higher quality, and they could really send that to monasteries and churches, and it was perfect for the church. But what the church didn't realize was this unintended consequence of print, namely that by lowering, again, the cost of literature and making it so much cheaper and easier to replicate literature, it led to this second consequence that new writing technologies almost always have, namely it led to new forms of popular literature. And it was Martin Luther who sort of stumbled upon that. He was a Bible professor who wrote in very jargony, arcane theological language in Latin about fine points of doctrine. So he was as far from a popular writer as you could possibly imagine.
Right, and you tell us early on he used quill and paper. I mean, he had no interest whatsoever in this printing press. And of course, by the time he's done, he realizes that this can place a German language Bible in the hands of any German who wants it. And the writings that he did expressing concern about the church eventually lead to book burnings or public burnings of Luther's writings. And you tell us it was good theater, the burning, but it wasn't very effective. Book burnings were no match for the flood of print, which Luther had become adept at channeling against the church. Well, at this point, I have to just throw up my hands and say, why can't we have more time? Because, of course, we have just scratched the surface. You take us all around the world, and you take us right up to the present day in exploring all kinds of different facets of the way in which literature has developed through the course of human history. The book, again, is called The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization. It's published by Random House, complete with many fascinating photographs and illustrations, the author, Dr. Martin Puckner. Professor Puckner, I congratulate you on an absolutely magnificent book, and I'm very, very grateful for this opportunity to speak with you about it. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me, Greg, and for this wonderful conversation.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Nancy.